Thank you so much for taking time to listen to this week's message. It's our hope that this resource will grow you in your faith, hope, and love for Jesus. Please help us get the word out by following us on social media and sharing resources just like this. And if this message has inspired you to take your next step in faith, please let us know by reaching out to us through social media or the church office. We are praying and believing that God will change you through his word today. Blessings.
Well, I want to introduce you to a guy named Marius Els. Now, Marius, he is a South African farmer, and he became famous right around 2009, 2010, when Marius decided he was going to adopt a baby hippo that was orphaned by a flood near his farm. Now, at face value, I got to be honest with you, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. I got a picture of a baby hippo. Let's put that picture up there. I mean, come on now. That might be the cutest thing you've seen all day. And at face value, I want a baby hippo. I want two baby hippos. I mean, I'll take that all day. Now, that is cute. And the problem with adopting a baby hippo is, do you know what the most dangerous land animal on planet Earth is? It is an adult hippo. These things, this is a modern day just monster. Like, adult hippos will grow up to about 7,000 pounds. They've been clocked at running at speeds up to 20 miles per hour. And on average, African hippos will kill about 500 people a year. I mean, these are not pets. And so despite the concerns and the warnings from family and friends, our boy Marius, he decided he was going to keep this hippo as a pet, and he gave it a name. He called it Humphrey. Humphrey the hippo. I mean, come on now. Humphrey the hippo. And over the next several years, Marius and Humphrey, they developed really an incredible bond, which is what brought our guy Marius into the spotlight. He actually was able to train this hippo to be a pet. And so they had a lot of great pictures that went viral. There's a picture of Marius riding on Humphrey like he's a horse. There's pictures of Marius swimming around in the water with Humphrey. There's even a picture of old Marius brushing Humphrey's teeth. I mean, they had a special relationship. But as Humphrey got older, he got in some trouble because he's a hippo. And they're just a little ornery. And so there was reports of Humphrey getting to the local golf course and chasing off golfers. Oh, Humphrey. And then there is the report of Humphrey breaking into a couple local farmers and messing with their cattle. And there was one time that Humphrey chased a grandpa and his grandson up a tree. And old Marius had to come out and call Humphrey away. I mean, just an ornery, cute little hippo. But Marius assured everybody, I've got it completely under control. He defended Humphrey, saying that he was a gentle giant, that he loved, you gotta get this, he loved Humphrey as a son. And he says this, Humphrey and I share something special that people just can't understand. And that's true. But what happened next? Well, we all understand what happens next, because old Humphrey the hippo does what hippos do. And one day Marius is hanging out with Humphrey, and Humphrey says, all right. And he dragged Marius out into the same river that he got saved from, and he killed Marius. Now, that's not a shocker, because that's just what hippos do. And I read this story. I don't know about you. I hear it, I read it, and I think to myself, how does this happen? How does this happen? How do you invite something so destructive into your life and you just play with it? How does it happen? And so the answer to that question is this. It's control. Control is how this happens. Control, get this, control is actually what killed Marius. It wasn't Humphrey. It was an idea. A belief, really. A belief that Marius could control something that was always going to kill him. That's what killed Marius. And so in Luke 15, what we find is a young son who is seeking control. So as Jordan said, we're in the middle of this series called The Prodigal God. And what we're doing is we're looking at a controversial story that Jesus tells to a group of sinners, tax collectors, and Pharisees. It is a story that is so scandalous that it redefines grace and it rewrites history. And it's about a father and his two boys. And one of his sons, his younger son, in verse 12 of Luke 15, makes a costly request. And so we've got the verse here. It says this, that the younger son told his father, I want my share of the estate now before you die. So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. Now, when you read this line, it's just easy to think that dad just goes down to the bank, withdraws some money from the ATM, gives it to his boy and says, all right, go get it. But that is not what's happening here. This request by the younger son, it is costly. Because what's happening with this request is that there is a breaking of relationship happening by him asking his father this. First off, there's a breaking of the father. Now, we talked about this last week, but during this time in the first century, if you were a good father, you would leave an inheritance to your children. Now, that inheritance, that would not be received unless you died. So for the son to look at the father, here is what he is saying. This is why this request is costly. It's breaking his father. He is saying, I just want your stuff. I don't really want you. It would be better for me if you were dead and out of my life. I just want what you can give me. And what's insane is the fact that the father, as the text says, does it. But this request, it doesn't just break the father. This request breaks his family. Something you need to understand about the first century. Your land was your identity. Most likely, this inheritance, this land that belonged to the father, it wasn't like the father just had cash lying around at the bank. What would take place is the father would actually have to sell a part of his land. He would have to sell it. It would no longer be in his family's name. And then take what the assets were of that and then hand that cash to the son. So for him to break his land is for him to break his identity. And this land, this estate, most likely had been in his family for generations. And so the son's not just breaking the father, but he's breaking the family. He's taking something that belonged to everybody, and he says, I want it from me. And I want to go do what I want to do with it. And then by breaking the family, you got to get this, he's also breaking the community that he's involved in. This isn't just about the home. This is about the city that they're involved in. Because when you were somebody like the father that had this kind of land, this kind of wealth, you employed people on your land. There were people who were servants that depended on this land to work, to earn a living, and to be taken care of. So for the son to say, I want what's mine, for the father to sell the land, it doesn't just dishonor him. It doesn't just dishonor the rest of his home, but it dishonors the city. What he's saying is, I don't care about anybody. I just want what's mine, and I don't care who it hurts. And he doesn't know it yet, but this decision, this control that he wants of his life, it's going to break the son. Now, we read the text last week that the father gives the inheritance to the son. The son, he goes, and if you know the story about the prodigal son, he goes and he blows the money on wasteful living. But him blowing the money on wasteful living, that is not what breaks the son. It's not the wasteful living. It's not the parties he's about to go throw. It's not the fake friends he's about to make. And it's not even the prostitutes and the pigs that he's about to go hang out with. What breaks the younger son is an idea. It's a belief. He believes that he is better without the father. That's what breaks him. Now, at its heart, you know what we call this? This idea that we're better off without the Father, we call this sin. At the heart of sin, from Adam to the prodigal, it's this idea that I'm better off without God. I think I can have control of my life. I think if I'm making the decisions, it would be better for me. And here's the thing about control. Control is an illusion bought at the price of peace. That's what the son is about to find out. And that's what not a lot of us understand, is that we desperately want control, but you got to understand something. Control, it's not free, and it is not cheap, and it is bought at the price of your peace. And so, what started out as an idea, it became his identity. And so sin, if you follow it, has a pattern that it plays out to. And Jesus, he gives us an insight to what this pattern is. As a matter of fact, in John 10:10, in one of the most famous chapters of Jesus' life, it's the chapter where he talks about the sheep and the shepherds and the gate and the way, the truth, and the life. In John 10, Jesus tells us that there is a thief. And he says this, that the thief's purpose is to do three things in your life. The thief's purpose is to steal, to kill, and to destroy. And so what Jesus is telling us is that you and I, we have an enemy. And that enemy has one goal, and that goal is simple. The enemy wants to end you. To end everything about you, to end everything that you're connected to end everything that you're important to. And the enemy of sin has a pattern that it follows, and that pattern is simple. To steal, to kill, and to destroy. It is simple but deadly. And so I want to unpack that a little bit. Because I think the same question I'm asking about Marius and the same question I'm asking about the young son is the same question I'm asking about me and asking about you. I just wonder, how do we get there? How do we get to a place in our life where we invite destruction in and we treat it like it's a pet? Because that's exactly what's happening with the son. At some point, this son gets this idea that he's better off without his dad, that he's better off making his own decisions, and he starts inviting things into his life that ultimately ruin him. And it's easy to judge Marius, and it's easy to judge the younger son, but the truth is every single one of us today probably has a story just like that, and some of us are living it right now. So how do you get there? Well, there's a pattern. So there's three things that sin wants to do. It wants to, first and foremost, it wants to steal your identity. See, once an idea can get inside your head, and once you start compromising here, it starts to change you here. Once an idea becomes my identity, it starts to change me. And once I start to change on the inside, get this, everything around me starts to change on the outside. And the first thing that starts to change on the outside is your relationships. So the first thing sin wants to do is it wants to steal your identity. The second thing that sin wants to do is it wants to kill your relationships. There is, if you don't understand the importance of the people that you surround yourself with, then spend some time reading through the Gospels. One of my favorite moments in the Scriptures is there is a paralyzed man, and he is brought to Jesus on a stretcher, and they tear the roof off the top of the house, and they lower him in. And if there is no story that tells us the people that are around us is important, I don't know what is. One thing we would tell students all the time is that you are the average of the five people that you hang around with the most. And if you show me your friends, I will show you your future. And once an idea becomes an identity, and once it changes you here, it starts to change you here. And then there are good people that you start pushing away. And there are some unhealthy relationships that you start inviting in. And what you find is that your relationship is killed. Is that not exactly what happens to the son? That the son is in the father's house. He has a relationship with the father, relationship with his family, relationship with his community. And all of a sudden, he decides, you know, I want control. And that decision doesn't just change it, but it changes his relationship with everybody that he's been with his whole life, because he's no longer in community now. Now he's outside of community, and he's hanging out with some people that just want his stuff, and they don't really want him, and we're about to find that out once he gets to the end of his money. And so the enemy seeks to steal our identity, kill our relationships, and then once you're isolated, like this is where it gets you, once you're isolated, once the people that are your ride or dies, the people that they're going to be with you no matter what, once you push those people out, and all you got is fake people around you, fake relationships around you, fake security around you. Once that starts to crumble, then sin's got you. Because the last thing the enemy wants to do is to destroy you, and it will destroy your life. And that's exactly what we're seeing play out here with this young son. And sin has a pattern. Now here, once you see it, this is really important. Once you see that pattern of steal, kill, destroy, taking away my identity, killing the healthy relationships in my life, destroying everything that I believe to be true. Once you see that pattern, you have two options. Two things you can do with sin. You can pray or you can play. You can pray or you can play. Now, for most of us, our reaction to sin should be pray.
We should have such a relationship with the Father that it insults us when sin tries to sabotage us. Should it not? That we would know the Father so well that we would feel the love and acceptance of the Father in the community of believers, that anytime sin comes into my life and says, hey, let's try a couple of these things out. Hey, let's look over here. Hey, let's have that conversation. Hey, let's start believing some of these things. We'd almost be insulted, like, come on, man. Do you know who my Father is? Do you know what he's done for me? Do you know what he says about me? Do you know about my family? The people that love me and care for me? Come on, you're going to have to try a lot harder than that sin to try to break me. I don't think so. Come on. I'm going to pray that thing away. And that should be our reaction. That should be the reaction of the Son. I don't know what sparks the idea that he thinks he's better off without the Father, but the moment that that thought enters his mind, he should go, why would I do that? Why would I ask for my inheritance now? Why would I go out away from this community of safety and love? Why would I do? That's crazy. Unfortunately, though, that is not our story, is it? That like the Son, we have been introduced to some ideas that we thought, you know what, let's play with that. Let's just play with it. Let's just think about that for a second. Let's just take a look. Let's just take a touch. Let's just step in. Let's just see what this is all about. Because you can pray or you can play. And when you play, you start to change. And then we get exposed for what we really want. You know the thing about Marius and old Humphrey? It wasn't about the fact that Marius was a guy, if you read his story, that had a big farm and had a lot of animals. And wasn't about the fact that he was caring about another creature that was struggling and down and out. Could have shipped off old Humphrey to the zoo. Do you know what that was all about? Control. When everybody said, there's no way you could tame a hippo, Marius said, watch me. And this Son right here, do you know what this is really about? It's not about really tasting what the world has to offer. It's not about making a bunch of new friends and blowing a bunch of money on the best party you've ever been to. It's about control. I think I'm better off without my Father. And for so many of us, the answer to the question, how did I get here? How did I invite this into my life? It's control. An idea. A belief that this thing that was always meant to kill me, I thought I could control it. And my Father who loves me, I thought I would be better off without him. It's control. Because we think at some level that maybe, just maybe, we are better off without the Father. Now, I don't know if any of us says that out loud, especially in this setting. And I've been doing this stuff for a long time. I can't think of anybody I've ever talked to that have said out loud, I think I'm smarter than God. I think I'm better than God. I think I don't need God in my life. I don't know anybody that says it, but I know a lot of people that live it. And we did a message a couple months ago about what has your mind, has your heart, what has your heart, has your life. And we talked about our heart's a sponge. And it's not really hard for me to figure out what you're about. I just got to wait and I got to watch because everybody gets squeezed. And when you get squeezed, what's true of you comes out of you. And so I know a lot of people wouldn't say out loud that they think they're better off with God, but I know a lot of people that live like they think they're better off with God, without God. Because what we really want is control. Now you might be here today and go, not me, Pastor. Nah, not me. I'm good. Really? Yeah, no, I'm good. I've got it under control. I've got it in check. I'm not a Marius and I am not a younger son. All right. Here's what I know to be true about sin. What you can't say out loud owns you. I just wonder, friend, is there anything in your life that you cannot talk about? That only you know. To speak it out of your mouth would bring shame. Because my guess is that thing just might own you. And what started off as an idea that we allowed into our life, without us knowing it, it became who we were. It became our identity. And as it changed us from the inside, we watched as relationships collapsed under the weight of what we refused to confess. And then for some of us, we have felt parts of us die on the inside without anybody noticing any change on the outside. Because that is what sin does. It seeks to steal, kill, and destroy every single part of your life. And here's the thing about sin. Sin will always feel like freedom until you try to stop. It'll always feel like freedom until you try to stop. It's like buying a bus ticket. Man, you get on that bus, let's go. Let's go. Let's get it. Let's see the things, feel the things, experience the things. Then all of a sudden, you don't like what you're feeling. You don't like what you're experiencing. You walk up to that driver and say, hey, I'd like to get off now. I think I'm done. Oh, no, no, no. You bought the ticket. So we're going to ride this thing out. And sin will always feel like freedom until you try to stop. And the point of what I'm trying to say today is I'm here in this moment, before we get to the back half of this message, is that I'm pleading with you to stop. Friend, I'm begging you. Some of us in the room today, we have invited some pretty dangerous things into our life. And I'm telling you, I know you think you're better than everybody else. I know you think not you. But you will end up another statistic. And what is happening right now in your life, and I know we don't even know each other, right? So like, man, you talking to me? I don't, maybe. But what I'm saying here is a friend, because I've lived it. And I've got some friends who have lost everything because they thought they could control the dangerous things in their life. And I think the text and what Jesus is trying to get us to understand in this is that you have a moment right now to stop. And I am begging and pleading for you to let it out, to let it go, and to let the gospel in. Because here's what my prayer is for us right now as we kind of turn the corner of this message, all right? Some of y'all are like, listen, Adam, I brought a friend. You got to encourage me a little bit. I brought a friend today. Okay, we're going to get there. I promise. All right, but listen, before we can talk about the good news, true, don't we got to talk about the bad news? Because without the bad news, the good news just doesn't feel good. What I'm praying today for us in this room is that you and me, we would have a Luke 15:17 moment. Because listen, in Luke 15:17, everything changes for this man. That there is a difference between our young son and our guy Marius. There is a big difference, because for Marius, he doesn't have a Luke 15:17 moment. Despite the warnings, despite the concern, despite the care, he said, I got this. I can control this. You don't understand the special relationship I have with this thing. Listen, we do understand the special relationship you have with this thing, whatever this thing is for you. And I'm telling you, friend in love, if you don't stop, it's going to kill you. It's going to kill you. So our guy in Luke 15, he is not the same as Mary's, because in Luke 15, verse 17, it says this, when he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare. And here I am dying of hunger. He is like, this is not working. I got no money. I got no friends. He goes, I am broke. I am hurting. I am hungry. And he says, I want to go home. I want to go home. And you know what he does? Get this. He says it out loud. Because what you can't say out loud owns you. And there's this idea that if we just keep things hidden in the dark, that somehow we're going to work our way through it. You won't. That's completely opposite to everything that Jesus tells us, that Jesus is light. And John would tell us in the gospel that he is the light of the world, and the darkness has tried to overcome it, but it can't. So maybe today, friends, what we need in our life is not more darkness, but maybe we need a little bit more light. Maybe our hearts need to be broken and we need to long for home. And our boy here, man, he wants to go home. And you know what I love about this? I love in this moment that he recognizes that despite the fact that he blew it as a son, he had the kind of dad that probably would hire him on as a slave. So then what happens? We go to the next text and he says, I will go home to my father and say, here he is, he's saying it out loud again. He's not letting it on him. He says, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you. I am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. So he returned home to his father. Now this is big. This is this big moment because this is what makes him different than a lot of other people. He says, I've blown it. I'm saying the thing out loud. I'm owning it, man. And I'm coming home because anything's better than what I'm doing right now. And I know there is a kindness in my dad that he would surely hire me on as a son. And so in this moment, I don't know about you, but in this moment, I want to know this question right here. What does grace look like? I want to know what grace looks like now, right? Because this is pretty messy, is it not? And let's just be real. This testimony of the younger son, listen, ain't none of you in here out sin that kind of testimony. You know what I love about the scriptures? Here's what I love about the scriptures. Let me just hit pause for a second. Zach, put that question back up on the screen because I want to go back to it. Here's what I love about the scriptures. The fact that the Bible doesn't hide its shame, but it exposes it. From Adam to Moses, from King David to Paul, the Bible does not expose its weakness. I'm going to tell you straight up. Aside from Jesus and maybe Daniel, we ain't hiring anybody at First Baptist Church from the Bible, all right? I'm telling you right now. They ain't getting past the trustees. Think we're gonna hire Adam? Hey man, tell me about your family life. Well, you know, there was this one moment that kind of just destroyed our family where a serpent lied to my wife and I just watched and let it happen. All right, we're not hiring you, man. Moses, think we're gonna hire our guy Mo? Brother just gets angry all the time. Gets angry, kills a man, buries him. Gets angry, smashes the tablets. I mean, he's just angry all the time. You think we're hiring David? Listen, Law, if you think you have the kind of story that's too dirty for the Bible, David slept with another man's wife, then killed him. Now, you got that on your resume, adultery and murder? Now listen, if you confess that out loud, I think legally I might have to turn that in, Jordan, right? If someone confesses to murder, all right. Paul's resume, one of the things he was great at was persecuting the church. You know what I love about the gospel? Is it's great, not because of who people were, but because of who they weren't. So friend, I'm telling you, this is a safe space this morning. That if you think your testimony, if you think your story is too grimy for the grace of God, you are mistaken, friend. And so chances are maybe you're wondering what I'm wondering, that if the son's coming back, what does grace look like now? Because that's what I'm interested in. I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm a church kid, okay? I'm a church boy, but I've been through some things, okay? So I'm not interested in clean grace. I'm not interested in the kind of grace that fits nice and neat in a box. I want to know, what does dirty grace look like? I want to talk about dirty grace. I want to know, what does grace look like, God? The kind of grace that crawls home, stained in pig poop, and you still got the smell of prostitutes and alcohol on you. I want to know, what does that grace look like? That's what I want to know. Well, I'm going to show you what that grace looks like. Here's what that grace looks like. That kind of grace looks like a chair. You might think, a chair? What does it say? It says, while he was still a long way off, the son, his father saw him coming. Jesus says the father saw him coming, which means this. You got to get this. He was looking for his boy. My guess, this is just Adam. I'm going to step outside the scriptures. This is just Adam talking. My guess is that the day that that son left was the day that that father started looking. And every day that father got up and he sat down and he waited and he watched. Not him. Not today. He'd get up, he'd go to bed. He'd get up the next morning, he'd sit down in that chair. And I just wonder how many times did people in the family come up to him and goes, what are you doing? He's not coming home. You're wasting your time. It's embarrassing. I wonder how many people from the city came up and said, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. He's not coming home, but that didn't matter to the Father. Every day, I believe that he sat and he watched in hope. He watched in hope, hoping that one day, over the horizon, one day his boy was going to come home. Can you see it? Can you picture a father? Just waiting. Just waiting for his broken boy to come home. And while he was a long way off, it says that his father saw him coming. And then the next line, it says this, filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son. Now listen, keep this line up here on the screen. He ran to his son. Now listen, this line should wreck us in the room today. It should wreck us, but it doesn't because it's 2025. We don't understand what this means. We think just dad's chasing after his boy. But let me tell you something right now. If you are a first century Jew, this line is heavy. It's heavy. The fact that the father would run because the father knew what every single first century Jew listening to this story knew. And here's what he knew. And I need you to lean into this. The young son's act of rebellion. It broke the father, it broke the family, and it broke community. So because of this, the son was subject to a Jewish ceremony called kazah. Now, here's how kazah worked. Kazah was when a Jewish man would shame his family and shame his city. And because he had shamed them, he was no longer welcomed back into the city. And so what would happen is that you would have a group of elders, and they would wait around, you know, by the front of the gate, you know, doing life, you know, just hanging around, doing what elders do, sitting in chairs, talking about life. And then if there was a moment where a young man who had dishonored his family would start making his way back to the city. You need to get this. They would grab pots, and they would meet the young man at the city, and they'd grab the pot, and they would throw it on the ground. And they would say, "This broken pot represents the brokenness of our community. You're not welcome here, son. This is your identity now." That was kazah. This young man was subject to kazah. So you read the text, you're like, why is the father looking? Why is the father running to the son? The reason why is the father has to get to the boy before the elders do. Get this. The father has to outrun the shame of the son. And the Bible says that he sees him. He has compassion on him. He runs to him and he grabs a hold of him. In the next verse, it says they embraced and kissed him. His son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son." But his father said to the servants, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house. Put it on him. Get a ring on his finger. Sandals for his feet. Kill the calf that we have fattened. We must celebrate with the feast, for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now is found." This is grace. This is grace. That the father, get this, the father outruns the shame of the son. He bears the weight of the offense. In that moment, the ring, the rope, the stake, they are symbolic acts of restoration. That by meeting him outside the gate, by restoring his identity, restoring his relationships, he has restored his life. He was dead and he is found. And get this, when the father walks the son back to the city, guess what the elders have to do? They got to take him back because he's not an outsider anymore. He's been brought back into the family. This is grace. And you know what else this is, church? This is the gospel. John 3:16 says, "For God so loved the world that," what did he do? He sent Jesus. He sent him. Not for God so loved the world that he waited. That he waited for you and me to get sick enough of ourselves to come home and to give the speech and to say we're sorry and to earn forgiveness. It says God so loved you. God so loved me that he sent Jesus. And get this, Jesus was broken so you and I could be restored. That's the gospel. So as we start to wrap this up, I think the question then becomes this: how do we come home? All right, you got me, Adam. How do I come home? You have to believe that you can. You got to believe that you can come home. Don't you get that when we look at the son, that everything changed in the son's life, face down in the pig mess, and he says to himself, I'm just going to go home. I'm just going to go back to my father. He believed that he could go back to his father, not as a son, but as a servant. And when he got there, the father restores him, but he believed he could come home. You and I, we got to believe that grace can be found in the arms of the father. You got to believe that. Listen, I can't believe that for you. My faith is not strong enough to get you there. Neither is your parents' faith, neither is your friend's faith, your spouse's faith. It's got to be your faith. Your faith cannot be rented or leased. It's got to be owned, friend. It's got to be yours. You got to believe that the God of this universe loved you enough to be broken to bring you back home. Because you and I, we got to do something with Jesus, all right? Listen, either he lived, died, and rose from that grave, or he didn't. Either Jesus was everything that he said he was going to be, or he wasn't. And I love Paul's honesty in Corinthians. He said, listen, we believe it to be true because we've seen it with our eyes. Because if it's not true, we should be pitied. You should feel bad for us if this isn't true. But what Paul tells us is it is true. And it changes everything. And my guess is it could change you today. It could change you if you would just let it, if you would just believe that it could. I want to go back to 2 Corinthians 5. I want to read this verse. We read this last week. We're going to read it through the whole series, and then we're going to prepare for communion. But 2 Corinthians, it says, Christ's love controls us. Christ's love controls us. Since we believe that Christ died for all, we also believe that we have all died to our old self. He died for everyone so that those who receive this new life will no longer live for themselves. Instead, they will live for Christ, who died and was raised for them. For God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself, no longer counting people's sins against them. For God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin so that we could be made right with God through Christ. That friend, you don't have to be a slave to your past. And you don't have to be a slave to your sin. That the blood of Jesus has covered the offense, and because he was made to be sin, we can made to be like him, and we can become right with God. That's the gospel. Paul goes on to say that this means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old life is gone. A new life has begun. And so this is why the story of the Father and the Son is so important to me, and it's so important to you. If the Son, I need you to hear this. If the Son gets to come home, you get to be in this room. Because grace doesn't wait for you to be clean. It just meets you in the mess and it walks you home. That's grace. So now, what I want to do as we get ready to prepare ourselves for communion, just friend to friend, all right? Eye contact. Listen, God knew you were going to be messy. And God didn't know you were going to be messy. Like, we do this weird thing that we think that maybe God doesn't know all the stuff in our life, or that maybe if he knew how your life was going to turn out, he wouldn't have died for you on the cross. That's the point of the cross. The point of the cross is it is this mighty picture of how much God loves you that he would pursue you. He will not let you go, friend. He will not let you go. So keep pressing, keep confessing, Keep walking. Don't give up. Because he will never give up on you.